You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Delighted to bring back on the show Dr. Ruben Steff. He's a senior lecturer at the University of Waikato, and he specializes in foreign policy, international relations, and global security. So, Ruben, welcome back.
Good morning, Simon. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, look, well, thank you for the last conversation we had. As you know, I thoroughly enjoy foreign affairs, and I've very much enjoyed our discussions. And so I'm grateful that you're here on radio to talk actually a whole range of issues. Working backwards, we've got the American election, we've had the Manawanui sink, and then, you know, a few weeks back we had the SIS, our Security Intelligence Service, put out their annual, or is it their recent, I'm not sure if it's actually annual, but their security threat environment assessment. And I thought if you're okay, we might just start there in terms of what did you actually make of this assessment and the various threats and challenges that they are perceiving to New Zealand?
Yeah, sure. I think a bit of context will be helpful for our listeners as well. I mean, this report comes out against the backdrop of an intensifying great power competition in our backyard, in the Pacific, between, well, the United States and its allies and what you might consider China and its growing group of autocratic allies in Eurasia. And the Pacific Ocean, our home, is the centerpiece for this new emerging confrontation. I was at a conference recently which a well-informed individual said to me he thought there was a 50% chance of conflict in our region in the next 5 to 7 years. If there's even a 20% chance, that is concerning. The fact that he was going a bit over 50% really shocked me a bit, to be honest. But the report, bringing that in here, it's blunt. It's direct, yeah. It's pointed, it's worth a read, it's short, and it names names. It does say, look, we are suffering foreign interference in this country from China, Russia, and Iran. There are paragraphs in the report that directly outline some of the methods, some of the kind of case studies, if you will, that they see playing out in New Zealand. So foreign interference is their top priority. It's then followed by espionage, insider threats. So that's people in positions of influence who willingly or unwillingly may do the bidding of foreign powers, and then violent extremism and terrorism. Because of globalization, we now know that violent content can just come through the internet to individuals in our country who may be vulnerable for a range of reasons and can quickly radicalize and then go on to conduct violent activities. Yeah, I stress it's well worth the read for the average Kiwi, and I believe that's the intent of it. The intent is for the SIS to be as transparent as it can be with New Zealanders, to inform them about what's happening. It does have these vignettes, like I said, these case studies, but it also has practical advice about what to look for and how people can protect themselves.
Were you surprised? I mean, I read it with great interest. I mean, both you and I have an interest in this area, and I too was surprised how blunt they were. More often than not, if you read earlier reports, they're very vague, and particularly around the China question, our biggest trading partner. Were you surprised how blunt they were?
Yes, but I think it is reflective of mounting evidence. And, you will have seen stuff put out the long game earlier this year, a documentary. So more and more Kiwis are aware what's going on. Of course, our parliament has been hacked. You yourself and Louisa Wall of the Labour Party, we know about that. We know about Anne-Marie Brady. So I think just the overwhelming body of evidence now has probably getting through to the average Kiwi, and this leads our the powers that be, if you will, the SIS, to realise, hey, look, we should be a bit more front-footed. We need to be a bit more honest, because you can't just sweep aside these things anymore. And it's probably growing in intensity, and more and more people are being implicated by it. Whether it's diaspora communities, maybe someone on LinkedIn getting a contract from some Chinese individual who's asking them to write a report about a foreign policy issue germane to New Zealand, whether it's hearing about intimidation on campuses. We have students on my campus who have been intimidated for doing research that involves China. So it's just more and more the body of evidence is growing, I think.
Yeah. And it says to me that they can't ignore it, in years past, you could arguably paper over it. But yeah, as you say, it's much more visible now. I mean, some listeners might be surprised to hear that Iran is mentioned. We do perceive China, we're sort of aware of Russia. Why would Iran be trying to influence things in little old New Zealand?
That's a really good question. I wouldn't be surprised as well if they are very sort of secondary to the China and Russia concern. I don't know, Simon. It's a good question. What I would add here, though, is that Anne Applebaum, she recently put out a book called Autocracy Inc. that's well worth the read. And it talks about what's happened is that these countries, Russia, Iran, China, North Korea, Venezuela, they are now coordinating their propaganda campaigns and turning out the tools, if you will, of information to project information into the Western democratic world. And they are going after concepts like democracy, accountability, transparency, the rule of law, because they know these ideas are a threat to their own systems. So if they can undermine them within our countries and we start to lose faith in our own democratic values and principles, it will insulate them somewhat because we will start turning against one another. We will start attacking our own values and the foundations of our government systems. So I think that's partly what's going on. It's a coordinated campaign, and even countries like Iran are trying now to reach down into even little old New Zealand.
Well, as you speak about some of the things that they might want to project here, they're probably succeeding at some levels, but I say that slightly darkly. But the government's responded not strictly to the SIS report, but they've recently announced they want to update our foreign interference laws. Do you see that as a positive step forward?
Yes, I think so. People I've talked to have said we are behind the curve here, that our like-mineds abroad have already these laws in place, and without them it does provide, you might say, foreign agents, whether they are official or unofficial, it gives them a bit of an advantage. The penalties are not as significant as they would be for people conducting foreign interference in other countries. It also can create a foreign agents register. So that's individuals in New Zealand who are lobbying whoever, government officials, local council, private business, that they have to officially register. And I think that would be a good step forward.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know me well enough. I think it is an appropriate step, something I was pushing for in Parliament, because at the end of the day, a lot of our law is actually, particularly for listeners to understand, I would suggest our laws are based on a Cold War mentality. And I'll always remember an intelligence official from New Zealand, better make that clear, talking to me and said, yeah, we had, this actually was someone from China operating in New Zealand. And when they approached them to warn them about what they were doing, the foreign agent, a Chinese agent, was saying, yep, but I'm not breaking any laws. So very simple example, but yeah, our laws didn't allow SIS or the police to actually intervene on what was going wrong. But jumping topics then, we've had, unfortunately, the sinking of HMNZS Manawanui, and don't want to drag you into the nautical side of it, but with your foreign affairs and policy head on, do you think the rest of the world notes this, and does this make a statement about New Zealand?
I mean, I've seen it pop up in foreign media. I think countries that care about where we stand and care about our military capabilities going forward are paying attention here, especially we're talking about Australia, the US, UK, and so on. As you know, Simon, and probably our listeners do, there's a defence capability plan that in theory is meant to be coming out by the end of this year. It seemingly has been kicked down the road a few times. So I think the loss of this capability will play into whatever analysis and discussions are going on behind the scenes. And as I understand it, we're looking to basically replace the entire Navy. Now, would this ship have been replaced anyway? I don't know. But it's not a good look. It's a loss of capability, what we have now. We have massive obligations. We have a giant exclusive economic zone. We have search and rescue obligations to the Pacific Islands to help them in response to, you know, cyclones and so on. We have to be able to, we have to have awareness. We have to have surveillance. We have to know what's going on under the sea, right? Foreign submarines in our exclusive economic zone, if not our immediate territory, are likely. That's why we have the P-8 Poseidons and so on. So yes, I think it's not a good look. Nonetheless, I think there would be some sympathy. I mean, these things do unfortunately happen. And the Court of Inquiry, it will come out in the wash what the exact cause was. And if there was human error, then there should be some accountability, right? That's how a functioning state and society should operate. But yes, it's a concern. As I understand, this was a former kind of commercial ship for some Norwegian oil and gas company. So you do wonder, did New Zealand kind of do this on the cheap? You know, would a more military specific vessel had more redundancy, more security, so to speak, so that this may not have happened, or the likelihood would have been less. So yes, I think going forward, we this could lead us to rethink how much we spend, the attention we place on whatever's going to come out of the defense capability plan. And other countries are watching, because if there is a conflict in the Pacific, whether South Pacific or further north, Northeast Asia, where have you, our allies and partners are going to know that we have a functioning military in place that can at least have some awareness of what's happening in our own exclusive economic zone, because that will be strategically implicated to any conflict that happens further to the north.
Absolutely. I actually had Ron Mark, the former defense minister, on recently, and he was talking first and foremost about the capabilities of Manawanui, from salvage to obviously hydrographic, so mapping the seafloor. What did they mention? Salvage, of course, littoral activities, which for listeners means the ability to move from the sea onto the land. So a lot of capability that now is at the bottom of the sea floor. And as you mentioned, Ruben, the Defence Force capability plan is trying to address a myriad of issues. So it's a big step backwards. But you're also quite right. As a commercial vessel, and Ron pointed this out too, it doesn't have the redundancies that a warship would have. But final topic, which intimated at the start, is the USA. How can we talk foreign affairs and policy and international relations without the great drama that is the US presidential election? What's your take on what's happening there at the moment?
I mean, it's a fascinating brew, isn't it? It looks like probably a coin flip going into the election. Kamala Harris apparently is probably 1.5 to 2% ahead in the general polling, but Trump is dead even in the battlegrounds, if not, according to some metrics, a tiny bit ahead in the battleground states, and that's where it really matters. Now, you know, you can listen to left-wing podcasts or right-wing podcasts, and they will give you diametrically opposed analysis about what is happening in this election and who has the advantage. One thing that stands out to me is that in the battleground states, the Republicans are making inroads when it comes to voter registration. I think that's significant. They have not overtaken the Democrats in many of those states, but they are cutting into that lead by quite a lot. That looks like a determined strategic move by the Trump administration. The Trump team, they've also outsourced the ground grant game and registration to private companies. And as you may know, Elon Musk is also, it looks like, pretty highly involved now in that ground game. He is offering monetary inducements for people that register others to vote in the battleground states. Like, he's literally tweeting about it and putting in tens of millions of dollars of his own money. I won't be surprised as well if Musk has been brought in to look at the overall strategy of the campaign. If you read the biography about Musk that came out earlier this year, he's an interesting guy, and he is basically a genius of sorts. Whatever people think of him politically, culturally, what have you, what he's been able to achieve, what he can do, his brain is it's off the charts in terms of knowledge, in terms of being able to make things efficient. So I think he may be a force to be reckoned with going forward. So for those who think he's an idiot and completely disregard him, I would say be careful about that.
But yeah, well, a lot of people have dished him in the past and say, like, hey, this is a man who's landing rockets. You know, just quickly, because some listeners won't understand the voter registration. People will know that, well, you register to vote and then you go in and vote. So why is voter registration so important to Democrats and Republicans?
Well, from what I understand, it's really a signal of intent to vote. If you're registered, you're just much more likely to get out on the day. Election day in the US is not a holiday. A lot of people have school might be going on. They might have jobs to get to. So there's a good amount of Americans who come voting day, sometimes just don't bother. They're too busy, or they think their vote doesn't matter. So they've actually signed something, filled out some paperwork saying, I register as a Republican or Democrat. That is just much more likely to be that added incentive for whatever reason to get out and vote on the day.
No, that makes sense. And thank you for clarifying that. I suppose final question, and we've touched on this last time we chatted, but from what's been happening in the rhetoric coming out of Harris's team and Trump's team, do you think, well, which administration potentially is going to reach more into our area, or are both going to be more looking inwards to what, you know, America wants? Are they going to become isolationist? Is one, are the Republicans still traditionally isolationist and the Democrats looking to engage the world, or are they a bit similar?
Yeah, I don't quite buy this isolationist frame, which often gets applied to the Republican Party. I mean, yes, they sort of profess to want to focus more on America's domestic issues, but that goes all the way back to Barack Obama. Okay, the Americans have been talking for years about nation building at home. Nonetheless, they have investments across the planet. They have a military extent that stretches across the planet too. They are concerned about Russia, China, Iran, etc. Now, could there be a deal? Could there be some negotiation with Putin over, say, Ukraine and some other transactionalism under Trump? No doubt. Sorry, we got a little 5-year-old jumping in here.
That's okay. We can edit. We can edit this. Edit this okay. out easily enough. So be relaxed.
Yeah, sure. So could there be a bit more transactionalism under Trump? Yes, but the first term showed us that the Americans remained fairly highly engaged in the world. There was some rationalization of their positionings. There was some shaking the cage, but the Americans are a global nation. And Trump once said, look, I'm both a nationalist, which you could probably code as a little bit isolationist. He said, I'm a nationalist and a globalist. I think, though, under Harris, we probably will just see the continuation of the status quo, at least for the early parts of her administration, while she finds her feet. By all accounts, she is not heavily knowledgeable or invested, I think, in foreign affairs, from what I can pick up. And on Trump's side, yes, I think there could be some deals. But nonetheless, the US will remain the US, and China will be a fixation of whoever is president, just out of necessity. Yeah. And therefore, the Pacific will remain a focal point.
Well, I think that's a good place to end things. I think, Steve, it's going to be a fascinating few weeks in the lead up to the election and, of course, the result. But Ruben, thank you so much for your time again this morning, covering a whole array of topics, and look forward to chatting again.
Thanks, Simon. Great to chat.
So that was Dr. Ruben Steff. He's a senior lecturer at Waikato University, specialising in foreign policy.
From caps to tees and bags to bumper stickers, we have you covered. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.